Therefore it is also obvious that there is no proper way of calculating the age of the Earth by comparing the amount of salts in the seas with the annual discharge by the rivers. The most that can be done in this respect is to calculate the rich amount of carbonates in the rivers in their relation to the relatively poor concentration to these salts in the seas. But then there will be no explanation for the rich concentration of chlorides in the seas in comparison with their poor concentration in the rivers. A part of the salts could be traced to the washing of lands and the floor of the seas. Chlorine is known also to be discharged by volcanoes, but to account for the chlorine locked in the seas, volcanic eruptions, whether on land or under the surface of the seas, needed to have taken place on an unimaginable scale. Actually, it was figured out on an impossible scale. Thus it was acknowledged that the provenance of chlorine in the salts of the seas is a problem unsolved. Paleontological research makes it rather apparent that marine animals in some early age were more closely related to freshwater fauna. In other words, the salinity of the oceans increased markedly at some age in the past. The most obvious and permanent effect of a deluge of extraterrestrial origin on the Earth would be the increase in its water volume and of the place occupied by the seas. Presently, 4/5 of the Earth are covered with water. A stupendous addition of water to the Earth should have decreased, not increased, its salinity, if the water came down in a pure state. But if the Earth was showered by torrents of hydrogen and water, some other ingredients of the Saturnian atmosphere could also have swept across the Earth's orbit. In the Buddhist book on the world cycles, the Visuddhimagga, where the catastrophes that terminated the world ages are described, it is said, "But when a world cycle perishes by water, there arises a cycle destroying great cloud of salt water. At first it rains with a very fine rain which gradually increases to great torrents which fill 100,000 × 10,000,000 worlds, and then the mountain peaks of the earth become flooded with saltish water, and hidden from view. And the water is buoyed up on all sides by the wind, and rises upward from the earth until it engulfs the heavens." Volcanoes which were active during the cataclysm of the deluge and during other cosmic upheavals vomited sulfur, chlorine, and carbonates, and contributed to the composition of the salts of the oceans. Carbonates fell on Earth in large quantities in some of the upheavals, certainly in the one which took place in the middle of the second millennium before the present era, at the very end of the Middle Kingdom in Egypt, an upheaval described in detail in Worlds in Collision. But a major portion of the chlorine in which the oceans are so rich must have come from an extraterrestrial source. My explanation of the origin of a large portion of the salts of the sea suggests that Saturn is rich not only in water but also in chlorine, either in the form of sodium chloride or in some other combination, or even atomic-free. The last solution, of atomic-free chlorine, appeared chemically and biologically somewhat difficult to contemplate, because chlorine is a very active element, seeking ties with other elements, biologically because it would be damaging to any plant life. Yet there are other indications which point to the possibility of plant life on Saturn. Saturn, the god of seeds. Saturn was called the god of seeds or of sowing, also the lord of the field fruits. A deluge destroying much faunal life must have caused a dissemination of plants. In many places new forms of vegetation must have sprouted from the rich soil fertilized by lava and mud. Seeds were carried from all parts of the globe and in many instances, because of the change in climate, they were able to grow in new surroundings. The axis of the Earth was displaced, the orbit changed, the speed of rotation altered, the conditions of irrigation became different, the composition of the atmosphere was not the same. Entirely new conditions of growth prevailed. Ovid thus describes the exuberant growth of vegetation following the flood. After the old moisture remaining from the flood had grown warm from the rays of the sun, the slime of the wet marshes swelled with heat, and the fertile seeds of life, nourished in that life-giving soil, as in a mother's womb, grew, and in time took on some special form. When, therefore, the earth, covered with mud from the recent flood, became heated up by the hot and genial rays of the sun, she brought forth innumerable forms of life, in part of ancient shapes, and in part creatures new and strange. The innumerable new forms of life in the animal and plant kingdoms following the deluge could have been solely a result of multiple mutations. Although this seems a sufficient explanation of why and how Saturn came to be credited with the work of dissemination and mutation, the mention of another possibility should not be omitted. If it is true that the Earth passed through the gases exploded from Saturn, it should not be entirely excluded that germs were carried together with meteorites and gases and thus reached the Earth. The scholarly world in recent years has occupied itself with the idea that microorganisms, living cells or spores, can reach the Earth from interstellar spaces, carried along by the pressure of light rays. The explosion of a planet is a more likely method of carrying seeds and spores through interplanetary spaces. The new forms of life could be the result of mutations, a subject I have discussed in Earth in Upheaval. But the possibility that seeds were carried away from an exploding planet cannot be dismissed either. The worship of Saturn. Saturn, so active in the cosmic changes, was regarded by all mankind as the supreme god. Seneca says that Epigenes, who studied astronomy among the Chaldeans, estimates that the planet Saturn exerts the greatest influence upon all the movements of celestial bodies. On becoming a nova, it ejected filaments in all directions and the solar system became illuminated as if by 100 suns. It subsided rather quickly and retreated into faraway regions. Peoples that remembered early tragedies enacted in the sky by the heavenly bodies asserted that Jupiter drove Saturn away from its place in the sky. Before Jupiter, Zeus, became the chief god, Saturn, Kronos, occupied the celestial throne. In all ancient religions the dominion passes from Saturn to Jupiter. In Greek mythology, Kronos is presented as the father and Zeus as his son who dethrones him. Kronos devours some of his children. After this act Zeus overpowers his father, puts him in chains, and drives him from his royal station in the sky. In Egyptian folklore or religion the participants of the drama are said to be Osiris Saturn, brother and husband of Isis Jupiter. The cult of Osiris and the mysteries associated with it dominated the Egyptian religion as nothing else. Every dead man or woman was entombed with observances honoring Osiris. The city of Abydos in the desert west of the Nile and northwest of Thebes was sacred to him, say in the delta used to commemorate the floating of Osiris' body carried by the Nile into the Mediterranean. What made Osiris so deeply ingrained in the religious memory of the nation that his cult pervaded mythology and religion? Osiris' dominion, before his murder by Seth, was remembered as a time of bliss. According to the legend Seth, Osiris' brother, killed and dismembered him, whereupon Isis, Osiris' wife, went on peregrinations to collect his dispersed members. Having gathered them and wrapped them together with swathings, she brought Osiris back to life. The memory of this event was a matter of yearly jubilation among the Egyptians. Osiris became lord of the netherworld, the land of the dead. A legend, a prominent part of the Osiris cycle, tells that Isis gave birth to Horus, whom she conceived from the already dead Osiris. And that Horus grew up to avenge his father by engaging Seth in mortal combat. In Egyptology the meaning of these occurrences stands as an unresolved mystery. The myth of Osiris is too remarkable and occurs in too many divergent forms not to contain a considerable element of historic truth, wrote Sir Alan Gardner, the leading scholar in these fields. But what historical truth is it? Could it be of an ancient king upon whose tragic death the entire legend hinged? Wondered Gardner. But of such a king not a trace has been found before the time of the pyramid texts, and in these texts Osiris is spoken of without end. There he appears as a dead god or king or judge of the dead. But who was Osiris in his life? Asked Gardner. At times he is represented to us as the vegetation which perishes in the flood water mysteriously issuing from himself. He is associated with brilliant light. After a life of studying Egyptian history and religion, Gardner confessed that he remained unaware of whom Osiris represented or memorialized. The origin of Osiris remains from me an insoluble mystery. Nor could others in his field help him find an answer. The Egyptologist John Wilson wrote that it is an admission of failure that the chief cultural content of Egyptian civilization, its religion, its mythological features again and again narrated and alluded to in texts and represented in statues and temple reliefs, is not understood. The astral meaning of Egyptian deities was not realized and the cosmic events their activities represent were not thought of. The prophet Ezekiel in the Babylonian exile had a vision, the likeness of a man, but made of fire and amber who lifted him by the lock of his hair and brought him to some darkened chamber where the ancients of the house of Israel with censers in their hands were worshipping idols portrayed upon the wall round about. Then the angel of the vision told him, "Thou shalt see greater abominations that they do," and he brought the prophet to the door of the gate of the Lord's house, and, behold, there sat women weeping for Tammuz. Next he showed him also Jews in the inner court of the Lord's house with their back toward the temple of the Lord and their faces toward the east, and they worshipped the sun toward the east. The worship of the sun and the planets was decried by Jeremiah, a contemporary of Ezekiel. But what was this weeping for Tammuz? Tammuz was a Babylonian god, one of the months of the year, approximately coinciding with July, in the summer, was named in his honor, and by this very name it is known in the present-day Hebrew calendar. Tammuz was a god that died and was then hidden in the underworld. His death was the reason for a fast, accompanied by lamentations of the women of the land. His finding or his return to life in resurrection were the motifs of the Passion. Tammuz was a god of vegetation, of the flood, and of seeds. The god Tammuz came from Armenia every year in his ark in the overflowing river, blessing the alluvium with new growth. In the month of Tammuz he was bound, and the liturgies speak of his having been drowned among flowers which were thrown upon him as he sank beneath the waves of the Euphrates. The drowning of Tammuz was an occasion for wailing by women. "The flood has taken Tammuz, the raging storm has brought him low." Of Tammuz it also is narrated that he was associated with brilliant light, with descent into the netherworld, visited there by Ishtar, his spouse. Tammuz's death, his subsequent resurrection, or his discovery in the far reaches, but no longer brilliant, were the themes of the cult that was not just one of the mysteries, but the chief and paramount cult. The Assyrian mysteries, the wailing for Tammuz, all refer to the transformation of Saturn during and following the deluge. Osiris was not a king but the planet Saturn, Kronos of the Greeks, Tammuz of the Babylonians. The Babylonians called Saturn the star of Tammuz. After the deluge Saturn was invisible, the sky was covered for a long time by clouds of volcanic dust, and the Egyptians cried for Osiris, and the Babylonians cried for Tammuz. Isis, Jupiter at that time, went in search of her husband, and Ishtar, also Jupiter at that early time, went to the netherworld to find her husband Tammuz. For a time Saturn disappeared, driven away by Jupiter, and when it reappeared it was no longer the same planet, it moved very slowly. The disappearance of the planet Saturn in the netherworld became the theme of many religious observances, comprising liturgies, mystery plays, lamentations, and fasts. When Osiris was seen again in the sky, though greatly diminished, the people were frenzied by the return of Osiris from death. Nevertheless he became king of the netherworld. In the Egyptian way of seeing the celestial drama, Isis, Jupiter, the spouse of Osiris, Saturn, wrapped him in swathings. Osiris was known as the swathed, the way the dead came to be dressed for their journey to the world of the dead, over which Osiris reigns. Similar rites were celebrated in honor of Adonis, who died and was resurrected after a stay in the Netherlands, in the Mysteries of Orpheus. Sir James G. Fraser, the collector of folklore, came to regard Osiris as a vegetation god. Likewise he saw in the Babylonian Tammuz, an equivalent of the Egyptian Osiris, a vegetation god and, carried away by this concept, wrote his The Golden Bough, built around the idea of the vegetation god that dies and is resurrected the following year. A few peoples through consecutive planetary ages kept fidelity to the ancient Saturn, or Kronos, or Brahma, whose age was previous to that of Jupiter. Thus the Scythians were called Amm and Manda by the Chaldeans, people of Manda, and Manda is the name of Saturn. The Phoenicians regarded El Saturn as their chief deity. Eusebius informs us that El, a name used also in the Bible as a name for God, was the name of Saturn. In Persia, Saturn was known as Kevn or Kivn. The different names for God in the Bible reflect the process of going through the many ages in which one planet superseded another and was again superseded by the next one in the celestial war. El was the name of Saturn, Adonis of the Syrians. The Bewailed deity was also, like Osiris, the planet Saturn, but in the period of the contest between the two major planets, Jupiter and Saturn, the appellative of the dual gods became Adonai, which means my lords. Then, with the victory of Jupiter, it came to be applied to him alone. 17. In the story of the universal deluge, it is said, in the 600th year of Noah's life, in the second month, on the 17th day of the month, the same day were all the fountains of the great deep broken up, and the windows of heaven were opened. 5 months later, according to the book of Genesis, on the 17th day of the seventh month, the ark rested upon Ararat. In Egyptian religious belief, Osiris was drowned on the 17th day of the month Athyr. The fast for Tammuz, commemorating his descent into the netherworld, began on the 17th of the month named for him. Although the similarity of the Babylonian and biblical versions of the story of the deluge was repeatedly stressed, the significance of the number 17 in the story of Tammuz in relation to the same number in the book of Genesis was not emphasized, or even noticed. The feast of Saturnalia began always on the 17th of December and with time. In Imperial Rome, when it was celebrated for 3 consecutive days, it began on the 15th and continued for 2 more days, until the 17th. The connection between the number 17 and the deluge is thus not confined to the biblical, Babylonian, and Egyptian sources. We meet it also in Roman beliefs and practices. The significance of the number 17 in the mystery plays related to Osiris drowning and in the festivities of Saturnalia is an indication that these memorials were related to the deluge. Festivals of Light. The deluge and the 7 days of brilliant light immediately preceding it were a universal experience, and they left indelible memories. Many of the religious rites and observances of all creeds go back to these events of the past in which the celestial gods Saturn and Jupiter were the main participants. Among the most ancient of all such observances were festivals of light of 7 days duration, held in honor of Saturn. The 7 days of light just before the deluge overwhelmed the earth are recreated in these feasts. Herodotus describes a nocturnal light festival held each year at Say in commemoration of Osiris' death and resurrection. It was called the Feast of Lamps. There is one night on which the inhabitants all burn a multitude of lights in the open air round their houses. These burn the whole night. The Egyptians who are absent from the festival observe the night of the sacrifice, no less than the rest, by a general lighting of lamps, so that the illumination is not confined to the city of Say, but extends over the whole of Egypt. In Rome, the Feast of Light was named Saturnalia. According to tradition, the Saturnalia had been established in honor of Saturn when, all of a sudden, after a lengthy and prosperous reign, Saturn suddenly disappeared. Macrobius wrote that in celebrating the Saturnalia, the Romans used to honor the altars of Saturn with lighted candles, sending round wax tapers during the Saturnalia. In his time, the festival was celebrated for 3 consecutive days, but, Macrobius wrote, and yet in fact among the men of old there were some who supposed that the Saturnalia lasted for 7 days. Phanovius says, long awaited they come, the 7 days of Saturnalia, and Mummius too says, of the many excellent institutions of our ancestors, this is the best, that they made the 7 days of the Saturnalia begin when the weather is coldest. Hanukkah and Christmas are both feasts of light and, like the Saturnalia, both can be traced to the days of the universal deluge. The Hebrew tradition that Hanukkah was established to commemorate the miracle with the oil that was found undepleted and sufficed for 7 days, is a poor rationalization. A better ground for a re-establishment of a holiday, so similar to the Saturnalia, in Judea, was in the fact that in the middle of the 2nd century before the present era, Rome conquered Greece. And about the same time, in the rebellion of the Hashmonaim, better known by the name of one of the sons, Judah Maccabi, against Hellenistic rule, the people of Palestine were drawing near the Roman world with its usages. It appears that the Romans fomented the revolt in the Hellenized provinces at the time of their conquest of Greece. Thus the Feast of Hanukkah seems to be an adaptation of the Roman Saturnalia. The observation of this festival was later taken over by the festival of Christmas, which was originally observed for 7 days, from the 25th of December until the 1st of the new year. Saturn and Jupiter. The history of this pair. The ancient Cronos and Zeus, or Saturn and Jupiter, as reflected in many traditions all around the world, tells a story that has nothing in it resembling the sedate and uneventful circling of these bodies on their orbits that modern astronomy asserts as a fact. Saturn and Jupiter are very much like the Sun. Were they not planets, they would be considered stars, like our Sun. Jupiter is nearly 330 times more massive than the Earth, and Saturn 80 times. Both planets are covered with gases which are in constant motion, like the gaseous atmosphere of the Sun. The Sun has 9 satellites and numerous asteroids and comets. Jupiter has at least 14 satellites and several asteroids and comets. Saturn has 10 known satellites, and 4 or 5 comets constitute the Saturnian family. Though these comets do not circle around Saturn itself, they are commonly regarded as related to the orbit of Saturn. Were Jupiter and Saturn free from the bonds of the Sun, they could be considered as stars or suns. Were 2 such stars set in space close to one another, they would constitute a double star system, both stars circling around a common focus. As told, the picture that emerges from comparative folklore and mythology presents Saturn and Jupiter in vigorous interactions. Suppose that these 2 bodies approached each other rather closely at one time, causing violent perturbations and huge tidal effects in each other's atmospheres. Their mutual disturbance led to a stellar explosion, or nova. As we have seen, a nova is thought to result from an instability in a star, generated by a sudden influx of matter, usually derived from its companion in a binary system. If what we call today Jupiter and Saturn are the products of such a sequence of events, their appearance and respective masses must formerly have been quite different. A scenario such as this would explain the prominence of Saturn prior to its cataclysmic disruption and dismemberment. It must have been a larger body than it is now, possibly of the volume of Jupiter. Interestingly, for certain reasons G. Cooper assumed that Saturn originally was of a mass equal to that of Jupiter. At some point during a close approach to Jupiter, Saturn became unstable, and, as a result of the influx of extraneous material, it exploded, flaring as a nova which, after subsiding, left a remnant that the ancients still recognized as Saturn, even though it was but a fraction of the celestial body of earlier days. In Saturn's explosion, much of the matter absorbed earlier was thrown off into space. Saturn was greatly reduced in size and removed to a distant orbit. The binary system was broken up and Jupiter took over the dominant position in the sky. The ancient Greeks saw this as Zeus, victorious over his father, forcing him to release the children he earlier had swallowed and banishing him to the outer reaches of the sky. In Egyptian eyes it was Horus, Jupiter assuming royal power, leaving Osiris to reign over the kingdom of the dead. If the descriptions of Saturn as a sun mean anything, Saturn must have been visible, in the time before its explosion, as a large disk. If this was the case, the increased distance between the Earth and Saturn could have been the result of the removal of the Earth from its place or of Saturn from its place, or both. Saturn could be removed only by the planet Jupiter, the sole member of the planetary family more powerful than Saturn. And indeed, the myth says that Saturn was removed by Jupiter. Nova. From time to time, once in a decade or once in a century, a dimly shining or invisible star flares with brilliant light. It may become brighter than any of the fixed stars, or any of the planets in the sky. It may be seen not only in the nocturnal sky, but in some cases in full daylight. It burns for weeks or months, then loses its brilliance, and finally becomes once more a hardly visible star. Such a blazing star is called a nova. The stellar nova seen in 1572 in the days of Tycho de Brahe belonged actually to the supernova category. De Brahe observed that the nova did not belong to the solar system but was one of the fixed stars. It was brighter than Jupiter and Venus and was seen at midday. For months it remained visible to the naked eye. Another supernova was observed by Johannes Kepler in 1604. An earlier such event, recorded in the Chinese annals for the year 1054, gave rise to the Crab Nebula. Other observations indicate that a supernova also occurred in 1006. Isaac Newton suggested a collision between two stars as the cause of the formation of a nova. The prevalent view is that a nova results from the interaction of two stars in a binary system when the two members disrupt one another on close approach. In such a case, filaments of the disrupted star are torn out of its body and hurled in great spurts, to be absorbed by the companion star. The sudden transfer of matter is thought to set off the star's cataclysmic explosion. With the development of spectroscopy in the 19th century, it was found by the displacement of the spectral lines that the gases of a nova move rapidly toward the observer, as also in all other directions. The star's atmosphere expands with a velocity reaching at times over 3,000 km per second. While the star's outer gases are hurled into space, much of the inner core remains. Star of the Sun. Saturn is not a conspicuous planet in the sky. Were it not for its sluggish movement, an unaided eye would hardly distinguish it from the surrounding stars. In many ancient sources, Saturn is called Sun. The usual name for Saturn in Chaldean astronomy was Elapsharmus, meaning star of the Sunday. Diodorus of Sicily reported that the Chaldeans called Cronos, Saturn, by the name Helios, or the Sun, and he explained that this was because Saturn was the most conspicuous of the planets. Hyginus also wrote that Saturn was called Sol. In the Babylonian astrological texts, the word Shamash, Sun, was used to designate Saturn. We learn from the notes written by the astrologers that by the word Sun we must understand the star of the Sun, that is, Saturn. Ninib was the Babylonian name for Saturn. Ninib in various places is said to shine like the sun. He was known as Atgallu, the great son of storms. The Greeks used to call Saturn Phanon, the shining one. If Saturn was always as inconspicuous as it is at present, what could have caused the races of antiquity, as if by common consent, to give to Saturn the appellative Sun or the Shining One? The astrologers certainly must have found it increasingly contrary to reason to associate the star that gives us light and life with one of the palest and the slowest of the planets. The folk etymology of the Hebrews explained the name Kima as meaning about 100, Kima, stars. The Bhagavad Gita contains the following description of a deity: if the radiance of 1,000 suns were to burst at once into the sky, that would be like the splendor of the Mighty One, the Shatterer of Worlds. All that we have considered up to now indicates that Saturn once exploded in a nova-like burst of light. The date of this event I would be hard put to specify, even approximately, but possibly it took place about 10,000 years ago. The solar system and reaches beyond it were illuminated by the exploded star, and in a matter of a week the Earth was enveloped in waters of Saturnian origin. Arrival of the waters. Following the 7 days when the world appeared to be ablaze in the radiance of 1,000 suns, the deluge started. First, according to the Hindu account, vast clouds gathered which overshadowed the entire world. These ominous clouds, rumbling and shooting lightning, overspread the sky. They were as vast as mountains. Some were dusky, some crimson, some white, some brilliant, in hue. Other sources describe them as yellow, or azure, or red. Loud in roar and mighty in size, they fill the entire sky. They were fringed with lightning, meteors and thunderbolts. Then, rumbling aloud with lightning, they poured torrential streams thick like chariot wheels. They rained with a sullen roar, inundating the three worlds with ceaseless downpour of torrents. And then there were seen on all sides the four oceans engulfing with tempestuous waves the whole surface of the earth. All creation was smitten by the luminous dense floods. In the beginning of the deluge, the nova in the sky shone through the splendor of the illuminated skies and through the sheets of rain, ever increasing in intensity. The biblical expression "the Lord sitteth upon the flood" was an apartment description of the blazing Nineveh above the waters of the deluge. It has a Babylonian counterpart in the title of Tammuz as Belgersu, Lord of the Flood. The Nineveh blazed terrifically, but soon the light became diffused, the shadows grew ever dimmer, the world that was all splendor and light turned gloomier and gloomier, the outpouring waters grew ever thicker, the clouds of dust darkened ever more the sky, and finally the drama of what was taking place on earth went on in darkness. The deluge was not a peaceful though abundant rain filling the earth with water, rising ever higher.